All right. Thank you so much to everyone for joining us. As Peter said, I'm Lisa Ryan, the Morning Edition host and reporter at 89.1 WBOI. And I'd like to thank our panelists for joining us as well. On the end, we have David Nicole, who is the president and CEO of United Way of Allen County. Steve Hoffman. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Steve Hoffman, president and CEO of Brightpoint. And Steve Garbus, reporter for The New Sun, which is part of the KPC Media Group. And because we have two Steves on the panel, I will most likely use your full names to differentiate between the two. And please, throughout the evening, you're a part of this discussion as well, so remember to tweet to hashtag #IssuesAles or just tweet at WBOI, follow us on Twitter, join the discussion. We'll take audience questions at the end. We'll go ahead and get started with the first question directed at Steve Hoffman, president and CEO of Brightpoint. Steve, what does it mean to be a part of the working poor?
For us, the working poor are those folks that are working hard, most often full-time, but cannot meet their basic needs. They still cannot generate enough income to meet all of the needs that the family has, from food to rent to utilities to childcare, transportation, all those different costs. We don't often split working poor with just any poor. You know, if they're not self-sufficient, that's important to us. And so we don't talk about it quite as often internally, delineating between working poor and poor, but that's how we would describe it.
Okay, now this is a very specific term designated by the government. So what kind of percentages are we seeing in Indiana? David, Nicole, perhaps you could answer this. What percentages are we seeing in Indiana and Northeast Indiana as well?
So what we look at when we're talking about the working poor, we use a term called ALICE, Asset Limited Income Constrained Employed. And we worked with Rutgers University to do a study in six different states and found out what that financial stability budget was. And in Northeast Indiana, for a family of four, that budget is $45,000. In Allen County, or I should say in Indiana, 922,000 or 37% of households are below that financial stability line. In Allen County, we're at 35% or 130,000 households in our community live below that financial stability line.
And do you know how much or how this compares to the rest of the country?
From the six states, so Connecticut was at 35%, New Jersey was 38%, Michigan 40%, Florida 45%, and California 46% of households were not at a financial stability level. Now, keep in mind, the dollar amount in California is different than it is in Indiana, but 46% of families in California live below a financial stability line.
Steve Garbus, as part of KPC Media Group, you've written many articles about this, and your articles were titled Working and Struggling. So can you tell me a little bit about why you called it that rather than working poor and how there's a broader term to describe that?
Right. Well, we wanted to, as we were working on this big package, kind of capture this kind of middle group. You hear about the poverty line. That's a very low threshold. In one of the sources I talked into, he said, you know, anyone living in poverty is someone who's not working, more than likely, just because that threshold is so low. So we wanted to capture somebody between that poverty line and between this self-sufficiency standard that is talking about being able to make your bills, being able to maybe start saving some money, start getting ahead in your life. And, you know, we'd heard anecdotally a lot post-recession that, you know, there were people who were working, or maybe they've got two part-time jobs now, or They're just kind of stuck in neutral, not going anywhere. So that's really what we were aiming to find with this package. And, it turns out there's a lot of people in Northeast Indiana who are kind of fall into that category.
Now, Steve Hoffman, who are these people? Are there any specific demographics that you see, whether it's age, education, family status?
They're all different kinds of people. We don't see a specific demographic in the people that we serve. I think definitely it's over proportioned in terms of single parent families, particularly single parent female families trying to get by on one income. And of course, we know females, there's a wage gap there, so that exacerbates things. We know child support payments are not consistent, so that exacerbates things. Definitely, among single-parent females, that's kind of a primary demographic for us. But we see all family types, all genders, races, ethnicities, ages, and the folks that we serve.
And beyond the demographics, it's who it is in our community. They're the backbone of our community. So it's the individuals that are taking care of our youngest and the individuals that are taking care of our oldest. It's the folks that are making sure that this floor is clean and quite possibly serving us tonight. So they are people. The reality is individuals living below the financial stability line, we interact with every single day. They're not those people. They're us. They're our community.
So I think either of you could answer this. How does this happen, and how does an individual or family get out of this working and struggling demographic?
Well, I think, how does it happen? It could happen to any of us at any point in time. As soon as a crisis happens within the family, you can't work anymore, you become disabled, you have major health issues, any of us could move to that point. I think some of the key demographics, some of the key indicators are education, of course. We want to see our kids move on to post-secondary. We're past the age where a high school diploma is enough to be self-sufficient. We need more than that. I think we have not seen wage growth. As we have watched cost of living increased, wages have not increased at the same pace. I was just looking at a stat the other day about minimum wage. And in 1968, compared to now, 68, based on cost of living and inflation, the minimum wage was $8.64 as opposed to $7.25. We've let a lot of our programs, systems, policies kind of fall by the wayside. We haven't kept them updated. We've not closed the wage gap between males and females. We're not being successful enough with child support. So all of these things add into really creating quite a few families out here trying to live on one income that just doesn't go as far as it used to.
Let me weigh in here, Lisa, since my part of the package that we did, I focused a lot on the numbers and taking a look at that data side, and certainly wages was a place that I started. Definitely correct when he says wage growth has not been there. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, but I always remember that 3% raise per year type thing. I looked at a five-year window of wage growth. If you got a 3% raise every year, your income would have gone up about 12.5%. In the 11-county region we looked at here in Northeast Indiana, stretching from the Michigan line down to Adams County, a little bit south of here, from the Ohio line, and then out toward Kosciuszko County and some of those areas a little bit further west, median household incomes went up 4.6%. barely moving up. For the median worker, it was about 5%, but at the median worker wages in 2014, the most recent number, that was around $28,000 per year, which means over that five-year period, they got a raise of about 67 cents, which is not going to cut it in this day and age. Gas prices are down now, but they were exceptionally high for a lot of that period. Food prices move up and down, rents go up, things like that. So wages are definitely not keeping pace in there. And in some of the research that we did in talking with the Indianapolis-based Institute for Working Families, one of the things that they noted was after the recession, there was this, they titled it a job swap, where a lot of high-paying and middle-wage jobs had left the state. Those were jobs that were lost. And what was replaced when the state was in this, you know, let's add more jobs, we need more jobs, we need to put people back to work, turned out to be a lot of these low-wage jobs, retail, food service, you know, kind of service area jobs that typically don't have the higher wage. So that's an area that, you know, people were back to work, but, you know, the joke was kind of, yeah, I know there's a lot of jobs out there, I have two or three of them now. So that wage growth was definitely a part of it, and part of that comes from education, skills gap. The wage gap here in Northeast Indiana is a thing. Females make an average of about 70% of what males earn here in Northeast Indiana, is what we found.
And to go right along with that, so of the in 2013, of the top seven occupations in Northeast Indiana, four of them were under $10 an hour. So they were retail sales, food prep, cashiers, waitress, and waiters. And all of those make a wage of under $10 an hour.
So David, how do people get out of this cycle of working a minimum wage job and still struggling to get by?
That's a great question. There are a lot of barriers in front of families living below the financial stability line. Quite often we'll have somebody say, well, just pick yourself up by the bootstraps. And of course the quick return is, well, what if they don't have boots? And that's one of the things that I think we are working on figuring out. You know, you see a sign on the road for a CDL driver, need a big rig, can get a job for $80,000. Okay, well, why don't you go do that? Well, you ask an Alice family, or you ask a family that's below the financial stability line, and they say, well, I don't have the assets to buy a big rig, and to get that job, I've got to own a big rig. So there are clear barriers. But I think there are, as we look at policies and we look at procedures, so from an advocacy perspective, we know, so we're the lead for the On My Way Pre-K program, which is for families that are below 127% of the poverty line. And we had a woman come in, and she had worked overtime so that way she could pay for her son's childcare. Well, On My Way Pre-K pays for that childcare. She made $37 too much. The value of that was $6,800. Because she made $37 too much, she couldn't get $6,800. So as we look at the supports that are there for those families, there is a cliff, and we call it the cliff effect. You go, and it's straight down. So we aren't necessarily creating incentives from a policy perspective for folks to work to climb out, and I think that's got to change.
Now, Steve Hoffman, what are some of the stereotypes facing people who are labeled working poor or maybe just working and still struggling to get by, and how does this negatively impact them?
Well, I think the primary stereotype is that they're not working hard enough, and that's really not, couldn't be further from the truth. It takes a lot of work to survive. I've written a little blog before about When my own family was in, you know, when we were in one of our no electricity phases around here a couple years ago, where I lost electricity at my house and spent 24 hours a day working on basic needs for the family, you know, trying to get the generator going. Where's our next meal coming from? How are we cooking it? You know, trying to keep clean water in the house, all those kinds of things. It's hard work. We do a poverty simulation at Bright Point that people go through, and they simulate living in poverty, and it's hard work. And when people are done with that, they're worn out, they're stressed out. It's very hard to maintain your basic needs. All of us put in a ton of work, and that's what those families face and more as they're trying to dig themselves out of it. So I think that's the number one stereotype, is they're not working hard or hard enough, because they definitely are.
And we're talking a lot about families who are in this. You mentioned earlier that a lot of the times it's a single-parent household. How does this affect children specifically growing up in a house where a parent is working but not making enough to pay all of the bills? David, you could answer this first.
You know, finding so if it's a family, their schedule, the schedule that they're facing is quite phenomenal. So let's take, for example, a mom that's could be, so it's a couple that's working, has two kids, and they've got to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and they don't know where their kids are going to go that day. They typically have a sitter, but that sitter's unreliable because they can't afford a center that is reliable. So they got to get up at four, take it to the first place, but they're not there. So then they go to the second place. Then mom's got to drop husband off at his job. Then she's got a 3-hour span before her job starts. She goes to her job. Husband ends up sitting at his job for a while until she can come pick him up, then goes picks up the kids, then comes home, and then she spends the next 3 hours studying for class, and then does it all over again the next day. So it's the schedule of a family that is below the financial stability line is really difficult. And so we know parents are the first teachers of kids. So being able to spend that time, especially if they're young kids, reading to them, playing with them, not putting them in front of a television, that's really, really difficult for an Alice family to do.
And Steve Hoffman, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think that there's lots of different statistics, but my favorite, because I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's the one I use the most, is that the difference between a low-income child and how many words they hear by age 5 versus middle or higher income children is 30 million. They hear 30 million more words than their lower income counterparts. That is just huge. That immediately puts them behind their peers. That leads to literacy problems. They just are less equipped to do well in school, and that gradually stays with them. And, you know, they struggle in school. They might drop out. They might not move on to post-secondary. And here we are. We're still living in poverty. So, and it's for all the reasons that David said. The parent is the number one teacher. And if they are spending all their time working, riding buses around town to try to get to places because they don't have their own car, they've got to get their children here or there, pick their kids up. Maybe they have to work two jobs. There's just not enough time in the day. So that's a big struggle, and that's where it hurts the kids.
And Lisa, let me jump in here. There is certainly the educational impact there. And for a family that is impoverished or living on a low income, there is always the threat that becomes a generational problem, that if the parents are poor or the parents are low income, you know, there's a much higher chance that the child is eventually going to grow up and then be low income as well. And education is key in this. I wanted to add this in earlier and forgotten to. I mean, looking at these education stats here in Northeast Indiana, a person with a high school education can earn about $29,500 per year is the median income. So, you know, half of people out there with a high school education are earning less than that. For a bachelor's degree, that is going to get you up to about $42,000 at the median level. So nearly double by being able to, you know, succeed in the local setting and then go on and get an advanced degree. And that's where, you know, in talking with local employers and stuff, that seems to be a lot of the problem is that, you know, people who don't have the educational background or don't have a skill set going into the workforce, you know, really have a hard time getting employed and staying employed and then, you know, earning an income, and then the cycle kind of starts all over again.
We're going to take a few minutes to talk about possible solutions, but I'd like to remind everyone to tweet questions to IssuesAles, #IssuesAles. And then after that, we will take questions from the audience. There's also, we're taking Q&As too, I think, right? So if anyone is not on Twitter, yeah. Okay, so we'll start with the two organizations, United Way and Brightpoint. What are your organizations doing to try to help people in this demographic? Steve, we'll start with you.
Okay. Well, we're doing a lot of different things, and lots of different programs for families to, one, help them build up their family stability so that they can then focus on improving areas of their lives that will lead to self-sufficiency. So we help with housing and utility assistance, trying to help people get health insurance, giving them the basics that they need so they can stop worrying about those issues, and now we can work on things like employment. We provide child care assistance, which is a huge need for families. If they're going to work or go to school, that's a big deal for us. A lot of case management programs, we want to work with families one-on-one to help them work on their issues, work on their strengths so that they can build the assets they have. We do a lot of early childhood. Again, up to age five is a huge developmental period for all of us. Most of us learn, and I forget the stats on that, but it's 90% of what we're going to learn by age five. That's scary in a lot of ways. But we want our low-income kids to be right on par with everybody else by the time they move on to age six. And we work with youth as well, because some of those decisions that we make at that junior, senior level, which is both making sure we get through high school and graduate, but move on to post-secondary, and we want those kids doing those things. So besides those kinds of programs, a lot of asset building programs, home ownership, small business lending, consumer lending, those assets help us all be self-sufficient. If you have a poor credit score, your access to capital is very bad, and it's very tough to get, and if you can get it, it's going to be far too expensive. If you're unemployed but you have a great business idea, let's try to get you capital. And not only will you become employed, you might be employing some other people eventually. So those kinds of assets we want to build with people as well, so they can draw on them to be self-sufficient.
David, would you like to add what United Way does?
Sure. Probably one of the most important things United Way does around families that are not stable is advocate for them and inform. So venues like this, but also when we got the Alice report from Rutgers, we took it out to the community and shared with the community, business leaders, et cetera, to say, hey, there is a population that is working really, really hard and not making ends meet. And to get rid of that stereotype of, well, just go ahead and work harder. They're lazy. They need to work harder. So helping folks understand that this is our community. This is what our community looks like, and a third of our community is not financially stable, and we need to do something about it. In addition to that, and I'd also say from an advocacy perspective, whether it's down at the State House, whether it's at a federal level or a local level, standing up for those families that aren't financially stable. And then from a programmatic perspective, we've got 211, which is a resource for anyone in the community to call to give or get help. And there's a navigating and trying to find resources for families, whether it is childcare, whether it is connecting them with BrightPoint or Lutheran Social Services. That's hard to do for a family. And sometimes they don't know where those resources are. 211 is an easy number that they can go to. On My Way Pre-K, in which BrightPoint is a partner of ours, but providing early care and education for four-year-olds before they go into kindergarten, so they've got a boost. And then we also coordinate volunteer income tax assistance. No family that makes less than $54,000 should pay for their taxes, period. Doesn't matter if it's Liberty Tax or H&R Block, no family in this community should pay for their taxes if they're making less than $54,000, because it's free through a partnership with the IRS, BrightPoint, United Way, the Volunteer Center, AARP. There are tax preparation sites available in the community. So we're doing a number of things.
Okay. And before we take audience questions, I would like to ask Steve Garbus, as you were reporting, what did you find local communities, maybe even statewide governments, trying to do to help this problem?
Sure. In talking with the Indiana Institute of Working Families, one of the things that they promote for is a lot of, keeping up with these social safety net programs, whether it's food stamps, which is SNAP, or temporary assistance to needy families, which is a cash assistance for somebody who's in some trouble. Their numbers show that the state hasn't utilized these to the maximum, and those numbers have especially been falling off as, the economy started to improve, and, there's an effort to push people off the rolls. I had recently done a story taking a look that in our four-county area that I work specifically with in the very northeast corner, the number of people on food stamps had declined by about 20%, which sounds great, until you talk to all the food banks and they say it's been just as busy here as it was 3 years ago, which means they're not getting that assistance from the state, but the people are still in need of, a really basic necessity, food. Another area that's come up is in talking about that job swap that I mentioned earlier, a lot of low income jobs coming in to replace higher paying jobs. And I started to see some of this when I had worked, especially on the south side of Indianapolis before coming up here, was this real focus in economic development and aiming towards a quality job instead of just a job. And the way that local governments, cities, towns, counties had kind of started approaching this was when a business wants to expand or grow, they typically come around looking for a tax incentive. Hey, can you give us a tax break on some new equipment, or we want to expand our building, can you, ease off the taxes for 10 years or whatever it may be. And using a real push to kind of take a look at the number of jobs being created, what kind of jobs they are, whether people in the area could fill them, what the wage was, and then kind of going back and crafting and saying, you're creating 15, 20 jobs, but they're lower paying. We're not going to give you as long of a tax break as to somebody who's plugging, millions of dollars in and creating some jobs that are $20, $25 an hour up there. That's a local policy thing that, governments, cities can do to try to encourage some more quality job growth.
All right. Thank you so much. And we'll ask the first question, which comes from Jordan Crouch of Crime Victim Care. She says, says, as a social worker, I see how systems can cause oppression on such a large scale. Helping individual families makes a difference, but it's still overwhelming. Where can community members help with advocacy on a larger spectrum, such as with policy? And whoever wants to take that question can go ahead.
You know, I going back to what he just said. So as we're looking at local governments, as we're looking at state governments providing economic development, we need to grow our economy in Northeast Indiana, and we're looking to get to 1 million people, and I think that's great. Let's make sure those jobs are high paying. And so providing tax incentives to companies that are bringing $75,000-$80,000 jobs, not to organizations that are bringing $40,000-$30,000 jobs. And as citizens, we can advocate to our, whether it's legislators, county council, city council, we can make those phone calls and we can pick up the phone. And then the other side I'd say is really advocating for the slope versus a cliff effect. So instead of having the cliff effect, creating incentives for individuals to continue to work, to get a raise, versus a disincentive where they're a couple bucks above a level and so they lose the dollars. Well, that's simple economics. So advocating to get rid of that cliff effect.
I think maybe part of the question too is how to get involved in advocacy. And I think there's a couple thoughts that I have there. And one is to just start. And I know that sounds weird, but that's kind of what I had to do. I don't know if it's a little intimidating to speak to legislators, to start to get to know them. But when I finally decided I have to do this, I got much more engaged with our state representatives, state senators. Most of them know me now, and I can talk to them about issues that we face. And a great way to get involved in that aspect, too, is to become a member of an organization that does advocacy. Jordan, your organization, you know, Crime Victim Care, can you make a case for that being community economic development? We may be able to. There's a state organization called IACED. That a big bulk of its work is advocate on issues just like we're talking about tonight, trying to make policies and legislation better at the state level. As an example, recently we fought an expansion of predatory lending that would have just been awful for the state of Indiana. They were right there leading the charge, helping get that, you know, voted down. So there's different ways, different groups you can get involved with.
All right, thank you. And our second question is, what are officials doing to change the kinds of jobs in the area that can help people get out of this cycle?
That's a tough one. Local economy, especially in this part of the state, and a lot of Indiana is very manufacturing-based. A lot of industry, especially auto industry, and up on the northern end, kind of in some of our areas, a lot of the RV industry, where areas like LaGrange and Elkhart were just destroyed when the recession started and people stopped buying RVs. A lot of the push has been to try to attract and diversify the business offerings, you know, move away from just auto manufacturing and try to bring in, you know, there's some medical technology facilities around here, you know, and looking into some of those, just diversifying the portfolio so that if one sector, auto, for example, goes down, it doesn't really hurt a lot of people. And tying in with that, one of the major pushes and one thing the state did get some good marks on when I was doing some research was job training. Skills gap is a major hurdle. If you're unable to do basic math or understand, you know, how computer systems work or things like that, you're going to have a hard time being employed. A Ball State professor I talked to said that technology has been great, Unless you're a low-skilled worker, that machine has replaced you and now made your job less valuable than it was 30, 40 years ago, where your job or where your body in the shop was valuable to that company because they just needed manpower to do things. So getting people additional training in college isn't always necessary, but if somebody could pick up a skill in welding or CNC machining or something like that, it can really boost their earnings. And those programs are available out there a lot of times at no cost. I know Noble County has an incumbent worker program where if you're employed at a company, they can connect with the county and actually get you additional skills training at no cost. They'll cover it.
Thank you, Steve. And we'll move to the third question from Jorge Fernandez, a teacher at Southside High School. He asks, what is the impact of incarceration on individuals on the work of your organization? David, would you like to begin?
If a child, so it actually goes back to early childhood education. So we know that if a child isn't ready to enter into kindergarten learning ready, the odds are they're not going to, and again, there are ways out, but I'm just saying in general, the odds are their reading scores in third grade aren't going to be where they need to be. The odds are their eighth grade score, math scores aren't going to be where they need to be, which means the odds are they're going to drop out of high school. When you look at our prison population, the majority of individuals in our prisons have not graduated high school. And then when they repopulate, when they come back in, we see a recidivism rate that is extremely high. And it exacerbates it. And then you have a mother or father who's not in the household that is not earning an income. And so you now have, you're now repeating the cycle with the next generation of kids. So incarceration is a symptom, not necessarily a cause.
It also has a major impact on your abilities. Which is one of the reasons why, I don't know if you remember a year or two ago when the state made this big push towards expungement law. And one of the reasons behind that was for these low-level offenders, people who had, you know, OWIs or maybe a theft or a low-level substance abuse type charge, that, you know, that was hurting their options for employment. Because if you go and there's always that checkbox that says, you know, have you been convicted of a crime? Yes, no. That's going to hurt your ability to be employed. On top of, you know, when you get into the criminal side, frankly, it's just expensive. It costs you money to bond out of jail. It may cost you money to hire representation. If you don't go to jail or prison and you're in a local probation or a community corrections program, there's a fee to do that. You are going to be working and paying. You're paying for the privilege to not sit in jail. A lot of the crime, at least in our area that I see, is substance abuse. So there's people who are out spending their money on substances that they're addicted to that they can't kick the habit. So you're wasting money. You're spending a lot of money. It's hurting your ability to earn money. There's a parent who may be out of the household for a period of time, as was mentioned. So it's a serious hamper on somebody's ability to earn and, you know, kind of crawl out of that lower income side.
Okay, thank you. And the next question is from Aaron Williams, who asks, what is more problematic, low-wage jobs or low wages?
Both. There are a lot of low-wage jobs, and wages not rising certainly are a problem. You can cut your expenses, but at a certain point, you get down to the bone where all you're paying for is your rent, food, electricity, and your other utilities, and, you know, there's not a whole lot else to cut. Low wages are something that the business side certainly has control over. They can pay more. But there is that skills gap that was mentioned. A worker who is low skilled, who doesn't have, you know, specialized skills or a lot of experience, or you hear from industries all the time about soft skills, things such as showing up on time, showing up every day, working hard, you know, those kind of things are going to have an impact on wages. There is a lot of low wage jobs, though, and I think that the median income around here shows that. It was mentioned at the top of the program, you know, it takes about $45,000 to make it here in Northeast Indiana or Allen County. The median household income in this area is only $49,000, which shows that, you know, just barely over half of the people around here are hitting that level.
And we kind of touched on this a little bit about how this is a cycle. This next person asks, how can a person on Social Security income start earning an income and more work when the risk is losing their Social Security?
I'm not sure I know enough about Social Security rules to be able to answer that, but I do think that that illustrates some of what David said is the cliff effect and some of the rules that we need to work on changing. A whole lot of programs operate the exact way that the questioner just described, and some, you know, food stamps, you can only have so many financial assets to even qualify. So not only can your income must your income be at a certain level, but you can't save money either, which is what we want people to do to move out of the situation they're in. So some of these rules we really need to work for change, and it's a lot of work. But so I don't have the answer on Social Security, but I understand the problem.
Well, and sometimes it doesn't even have to be, you know, risk of losing benefits specifically. One of the families that one of our reporters talked to was a couple. They had three small children. He was working a not very high wage job, earning maybe $32,000-$35,000, but for a, you know, a married couple with three children, that's not going to cut it around here. And she was not working. She was staying at home, and kind of the problem was, you might be able to go back to work, but if you do so, now you have three kids that you need to put into childcare. So is it even going to be worth it to go to work if you have to pay to now put three kids in daycare? You know, one kid in daycare is enough. I don't know that you get a bonus for enrolling multiple kids, but, you know, and I've run into that a lot when talking with people on the lower end of the spectrum, is that they will make decisions often with kids to, I'm going to stay home and take care of my kids because it would cost me nearly just as much as I would earn by going back to work, and I'd lose out on that time, you know, with them.
Okay. And Jeanette asks, why has no one tonight proposed encouraging young people to hold off on having kids until they're educated, married, employed, and in a good home?
Well, it's a fair question, I think, and certainly having a child is a big expense. And I think, you know, we heard that a lot of single parent households are in trouble. I don't know that there's a good answer to that. You can't tell people how to live their lives. You know, some people will do it and some people not. I'm 30, married, and don't have any kids yet. We just purchased a house, so we're on that path. To me, that seemed like a good idea. But for other people, I can't speak to their circumstances.
So as we look at Alice families, 71% of Alice families in Indiana don't have kids. So I don't know that it's I won't disagree with the comment, but I don't know that it's necessarily a child issue. There are clearly the majority of families that are living below the financial stability line don't have kids, as in it's 661,000 households in Indiana. So it's not necessarily a child issue.
Are there also families then who perhaps were able to afford their children when they had them and then became unemployed or underemployed. Is that part of that demographic at all as well?
Absolutely. One of the families we talked to for this package was a younger married couple. They had a small girl, if I'm remembering correctly, and he was working. He had a good manufacturing job, and then he got laid off. He was out of work for a month, 6 weeks, and you know, what little savings they had evaporated pretty quickly. By the time he did have a friend who got him in on a new job, you know, earning similar to what he was, great, you're back where you started, but you've just lost, you know, 4 to 6 weeks of expenses to, you know, pay your rent and buy food and stuff like that. And their savings was wiped out. One of the things I came across, and actually this was something Steve had mentioned to me when I talked to this, talked to him for the story, was this idea of being asset poor. You don't have savings, you don't have credit to go out and get a loan, maybe you don't have a car, you more than likely don't own a house that is an asset or that you might be able to borrow against. So for somebody who is working and does go through one of those life-changing events, losing a job, going through a divorce, something like that, it's you could get into trouble pretty quickly.
I think what's very key to remember is that people are in this situation for all different kinds of reasons. And what they need to get out of it is all different kinds of barriers that they need to cross, all different kinds of assets they need to achieve. Sure, there's lots of families we serve that had kids too young. I would agree with that. There's a lot of families we serve that were great families, and something happened. And now, you know, it's a single parent household. The kids didn't ask for any of this. They're just trying to live their lives and move on. So there's lots of reasons besides just having kids too young.
Yeah, if solving economic hardship was easy, we probably would have done it by now. It's much more complicated.
Steve, you mentioned having a car as an asset that many low-income families or individuals don't have, and we do have a comment from Garrett who says mass transit is a big help for low-income people. So can you talk a little bit about Northeast Indiana specifically and our mass transit and whether anything's being done to sort of help expand that at all?
The Steve?
Steve mentioned the car, but sure.
Well, I'm happy to comment.
He's the one who told me about it, so we'll let him speak to it.
Well, I think certainly we can use more mass transit. There's no question about that. But I think for our region, and we've done a lot of studying of this at Bright Point, when you think about Fort Wayne itself, but also the region, we're very spread out. Fort Wayne's a very spread out city. The jobs are all over the place. So for someone living in this area to find a job, a good paying job, they may need to be looking out on DuPont or out in a Boyd somewhere. And mass transit, even if we had lines out there, think about how long that family would be on that bus, and add to that getting their children to daycare and getting groceries on the way back home. Mass transit is very helpful in certain circumstances, but it's not by any means our answer to the transportation needs we have. Among our clients, 75% have private transportation, 25% do not, meaning they do not have a car, and 80% of them say this is a huge barrier to better employment for me, that I can't get to where the good jobs are, the higher paying jobs are, and it's just a huge, huge barrier. Not a lot of resources out there to try to handle this. It's a very expensive barrier. But we have to do something to try to chip away at that issue.
Well, and you're going to see less rural mass transit in a rural area, specifically where I work. There is a local bus service. It's a transport service. It does serve, you know, seniors and people with disabilities and stuff like that. I'm not sure how open it is to everyone. But, I mean, depending on where you live, you know, where my office in Kendallville is 15 to 20 minutes from Albion, which is the county seat in Noble County, where there's a lot of factories and stuff. So if you don't have a car, you can't make that trip. You cannot get a job in Albion if you live in Kendallville and don't have a vehicle or access to reliable transportation. It's just not going to work.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We're going to have to wrap it up unless there's any final thoughts from the panel. Does anyone have any? Okay. Thank you so much, and we didn't get to all of the questions, so I'm sorry about that, but we'll try to address that in future reporting. I'd also like to remind everybody that the next section is on combating opioid abuse, so stick around for that. We'll take a short break before that, and I also invite you to put your name into the drawing, and that's going on at the table near the door. You can put your name into a drawing and win a prize. And thank you so much to everyone for coming out tonight, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks.